Blog Talk Radio.
Four. They're coming to get you, Barbara.
What's up, guys? How's it going? Oh my God, we are a week away from Black Wednesday. I freaking can't wait, guys. I'm excited. Anyway, this is the Gore Girl Variety Hour. I am your host, Gore Girl, coming to you live from the crypt, as usual, in your face and ready to go. Once again, Techie Ed is still AWOL. He's still running away from that necrophiliasm. Oh my God, guys, we wish him well. I hope to God. I told Tech he had to get a hold of us. I don't know what's going on. But anyway, we got a great show. Tonight we got Rob Dunbar, author of The Pines, which is basically a novel he constructed about the Jersey Devil. So I've been telling people, think Chupacabra, guys. So anyway, he drops by the GG Studios a little later. We got a craziness. We got a little something for Techie Ed at the end of the show. It's nuts, guys. It's absolutely crazy. So we got a little cryptozoology for you. We got a little serial killer-isms for you. So it's going to be nuts, guys. And what do you expect from the GG Hour except insanity? You expect serial killers. You expect cryptozoology. You expect all this crap. You expect things to pop out of you with a garbage can and scream. I don't know, guys. It's incredible. So anyway, welcome. Let's get on with this because I have to talk about something that blew my mind, guys. Absolutely blew my mind. I don't know how many of you guys have seen this. I'm just going to give you a little news first because I know I'm going to get so excited talking about what happened to me Monday that I'm going to forget to tell you guys this. We're going to go right into Rob. It's going to be insanity, and then no one will know what will happen. Anyway, does any of us know what's happening? And look at this. Now I got stuff popping up all over the place on the tech board. This is what happens when Techie Ed's not here. I got things popping up. I'm like, what is this? Why does this button say self-destruct? Why is the computer melting? What's this strange burning smell? I don't know. See, these things you can't identify. But, guys, I am doing the best I can to bring you the entertainment, the variety section of our show while doing the tech stuff, which usually I don't do, but guys, working with it, so work with me. This is actually our third episode on the Horror Movie Fans Radio Network, which is awesome. That's pretty cool. We're still getting used to it, all the tech stuff, not to mention that Blog Talk sucks, but we didn't say that. I don't know who said that. Blog Talk's awesome. Yeah, they don't ever mess up or anything. Cool. Anyway, let's get down to it, guys. I'm already rambling. My mind is chaotic because there's so much good stuff going on right now. And I'm prepping for next week, guys, because you know what's next week. Black Wednesday. Okay, yes, I know everyone's going to be out getting trashed. But you do know what we're doing next Wednesday and what you're going to be sitting there listening, stroking your computer to, right? The Gore Girl Variety Hour welcomes Lloyd Kaufman on Black Wednesday. What perfect, I mean, how much better can you get for Black Wednesday? A holiday to celebrate getting trashed and to avoid your family for the holiday. And the guy that comes up with Night of the Chicken Dead, Toxic Avenger, you know what I mean? I don't know. It kind of goes hand in hand for me. I'm actually shedding a tear as I speak. I'm salivating over the microphone and shedding a tear. It's an amazing thing, guys. It's like sex with a chicken. I don't really know what else to say, guys. Techie Ed, well, I don't know. He's doing things with corpses. I don't know what's happening. But that one's for you guys. Anyway, I got to give you two pieces of little hit tidbits here. And I didn't really want to go too much into it because everybody knows I always bring you the hot horror news. I always let you know what movies are coming out, let you know what's going on, what's on somebody's table that they're talking about doing, who's blowing who, all that good stuff, you know, who's, you know, basically severing each other's limbs, whatever. Anyway, I think I just broke the studio. Oh, well, whatever. That's why we have duct tape. So anyway, guys, for those of you that don't know who I am, that's sacrilegious, but that's okay. I guess we'll just go with it. No, just kidding. Oh, God, guys, it's a variety show. You're supposed to have fun. My whole goal is to make you laugh, to take you out of your reality for a couple hours, to, you know, give you some old-fashioned vaudeville, some Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, as Chevy Chase says in Christmas Vacation, some, tap dancing with Danny F and K kind of stuff right here. So this is what we're going to be bringing you guys. Anyway, I got to give you two tidbits, all right? I always bring you the hot news, stuff like that. We go into a big thing, you know, we start getting all the stuff. Nobody knows what I'm talking about half the time. But I'm only going to mention two things, too, because these are the two things that actually interested me of all the crap that's out there. There's actually reports, guys, that they're coming out with Tremors 5. It's called The Thunder from Down Under. Sounds like a porn to me, but okay. I'll go with it. Okay. It's Graboids. Sure. Cool stuff. Of course, Stampede Entertainment, we assume they're behind it. We assume they have something to do with it. There's basically no plot, no word of anything. It's just basically something that was thrown out there that somebody caught wind of. Just like Goonies 2 that never happened that I was excited about. I don't understand why they couldn't have made the Goonies 2. I would have been first in line for that crap, but, you know, whatever. I don't know. It's not like I read the fan blogs or anything about people breaking in and trying to steal the script. No, not that I was one of them or anything. But anyway, so I'm excited about that, guys, because I am a Tremors fan, all right? I mean, everybody, I'm sure, is a Tremors fan. The first one, the sequel's just, no, I don't know what was going on there. I mean, come on. I don't know what's going on there. We didn't need, you know, Michael J. Fox's dad, you know, in every sequel, you know, trying to teach us lessons and fight Graboids. And, yeah, just it wasn't working for me, guys. But, no, I love first Tremors. I mean, that was classic. I used to sit with my sisters growing up, and they had the, you know, they have it on TBS, and you can just, like, I've seen it so many times on TV, I could time the commercials perfectly. You know in the movie, up, that drop right there, that's a commercial. Up, that cut scene, yeah, that's a commercial right there. So, I mean, it's insane. But this, of course, is the generation that I grew up with, was that all these great horror films, these schlocky horror films were on like TBS, TNT, you know, WGN, all this crap. And, you know, of course they got out the good stuff, but they were just so campy and so crazy. I just remember being a kid getting all into them and just loving them. So it was good stuff, along with Svengoolie. I mean, everybody has their favorite horror host that they have. So I am excited that Tremors is still alive. Am I excited for a sequel? No, not really. The first one was good enough, guys. I didn't need four more to reiterate to me how much I love the first one. But hey, that's just another kind of thing of Hollywood that's padding their pockets with our tear-stained dollars. Anyway, there is something really cool that I had heard about a while back. Wasn't sure if they were actually doing it or they were going to shirk us on it, guys. But it looks like they're going to come through. There's a documentary out there. It actually premiered at the Denver Film Festival. It's called His Name Was Jason, 30 Years of Friday the 13th. I had heard about this, God, a long time ago. And I knew that my old, you know, I don't even know what I should call him, my old mentor, my old harassment partner, whatever. Anyway, the guy who I have a restraining order against, I don't know. Anyway, I knew that Tom Savini was going to be hosting. You know, Tom's going to call me, and he's going to be like, Sabrina, why? Just why? Why are you saying stuff about me? I'll be like, Tom, you love it. Shut up. Take it, Tom. Anyway, so it's going to be hosted by special effects master Tom Savini. I heard it's going to have, like, tons of interviews. It's going to have interviews with every single Jason. It's going to have interviews. This is the new thing. You're in the Gore Girl world, guys. It's interviews. Anyway, it's going to have interviews with every Jason, all the final girls who supposedly survived him, clips from the films. They're going to talk about how it started off as a kernel, as obviously every movie has to, how it started off as a ghost story told around a bonfire and blew up into this franchise and this horror movie megacon that it is. So I'm excited about that because I'd heard about it and I thought that they were just going to do something crappy like throw a 5-minute DVD together as part of like a 10-disc series or something, which I hate when they do that. You get all excited, you're blowing like $200 on this huge series set and you get like one crappy DVD that has like, I don't know, a sentence in it that you didn't know before. Jason, like the color red. Oh, well, I'm glad I paid $200 to know that because yeah, that was important. So, I don't know, just got to say that. But guys, I got to talk to you about something that's really cool. As you know, I'm into some of the macabre stuff. I'm into some of the crazy stuff. I mean, come on. This is Gore Girl here, you know, being in the horror film industry, you know, working on the films, working with people like Savini and Ed Neal and Gunnar Hansen, all these guys. You kind of, you know, you get used to this lifestyle, this thing. You know, I've always been addicted to horror, you know, always you know, dissected it, philosophized about it, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, brings an interesting take. But, yeah, and I've always been the paranormal, always been a ghost hunter, stuff like that. So, of course, serial killers just kind of goes in it. And everybody that knows me knows it's, like, a crazy passion of mine. That's, like, this weird little fetish, I guess, I have about serial killers. I don't know. I love their psychology. I love getting in their minds. You know, I mean, I've read autopsy reports and more photos and case files and, you know, final interviews and mob mentality and all that crap that's going on, newspaper ads and you know, letters and infamy and DNA and all sorts of crap. And I just absolutely, yeah, you can tell how much I love it. Yeah, it's crap and that crap over there. And then I like some more of this crap right here. And, oh, yeah, don't forget about that crap. That's some good crap right there. at least I'm not swearing. It's all good. So at least I'm not using one of George Carlin's 7 naughty words. So anyway, I'm really into the serial killer thing, guys, and, you know, I think it's fascinating. I think it's absolutely fascinating because I've said time and again, what you don't see is far scarier than what you do see, and everything in your subconscious, you know, it's been proven. We have yet to explore our subconscious. We don't know what lies in there. We don't know what instincts, what primal urges, what sadism, what, you know, whatever, what, you know, miracles, whatever you want to call it, lie in that space. You know, it's completely untapped. I'd like to say that the subconscious is like, you know, the last uncharted territory, you know, the last, you know, native land that man has yet to dwell into. So I don't know, it's just, you know, your subconscious is a crazy place. And I mean, this is where these guys come from. They get these primal urges and they're, you know, just separated from right and wrong. I mean, I could go into the psychology of, you know, what it's divided into and who does what and what are the signs and why this happens and how this experiences that and affects that. I mean, God, you know, you get these psychiatrists that can go on for hours about this, and that, and oh, yeah, he liked the color red too, so he's like Jason Voorhees, you know, I mean, just insane stuff, but I don't know, they're fascinating. I think it's because they're a little bit frightening, because these people have so much power and so much blankness. It's like Michael Myers. It's like you're facing off against Michael Myers. They're faceless. They, I mean, yeah, okay, obviously they have a face, they don't wear a mask, well, some of them don't wear a mask. But, I mean, seriously, it's like you're facing off with these people, and God knows what's inside of them and what they're capable of. And, you know, just thinking about that, you're like, oh, wow, well, I don't know. Could I chomp on a human leg bone? I don't know. I mean, it might get kind of sticky, you know. I barbecued, or I get a little, like, you know, little wipey things for your mouth. I mean, there's so many things that go into questioning if you're going to turn into one or not, you know. I'm sure they sit and agonize for hours. Well, I don't know if I have the right clothes to do it. I don't know. You know, I don't want to get this shirt dirty. I mean, I'm sure there's so much that goes into it. But, and now they're going to lock me up. They're going to be like, and get the stretcher, guys. Let's put this one away. But anyway, so I just absolutely love serial killers. I just thought I'd preface that. Don't confuse what I'm saying. I don't wish that if you are a serial killer, you come visit me. I don't love you that much. I'm just saying on a general, weird hobby. You know, some people collect lint. I don't know. On a weird hobby scale, I like that. So please keep yourselves hidden. I don't need to see anything. You know, I got techie yet, you know, screwing 78-year-old men over here. I don't know. I've seen enough. I've seen enough horror in my lifetime. So anyway, I went and I saw Changeling, guys, that Angelina Jolie movie. Okay, yeah, stop groaning. I didn't know what to expect, okay, because I didn't really read about it. I've been so busy. You know, I do the international radio show, the Ghost Man Demon Hunter show. You know, busy with those guys. You know, we've been, you know, trying to get things rolling. I'm trying to get stuff set up for the Christmas. And, you know, obviously doing this show, we've got the website we're working on. There's so many crazy things happening. And so I'm like, okay, all right, you know, I don't really have time to go see a lot of films. You know, I try to see as many as I can. And, you know, I go through, I have so many people that send me their indie films and want me to review them on the shows, stuff like that. So digging through all this stuff, and you know, I wanted to see this movie, but I wasn't sure what it was about. I knew it was, okay, the mom, okay, her kid goes missing, you know, might be a government conspiracy, somebody has something to do with it. That's kind of where you're leading to, right? Unless you read a huge review of it, you don't know what it is. You're like, okay, all right, I'm going with it. Well, I wanted to see it because I love period pieces, guys. I love the 20s, the 30s. Those are my favorite times, the roaring 20s, you know. I mean, even though the 30s was, you know, the Depression, it still, to me, is a fascinating time. You know, the cars, the hair, the clothes, the demeanor, you know, the even the celebrities back then, that was style, that was grace, that was passion, you know, it was class. There was so, it was such a different league, a different time. And I don't know, I mean, now we're a bunch of bumbling buffoons, bumbling band of buffoons. There you go, a little Harry Potter for you. But I mean, you know, that was just wow. You know, I mean, yeah, the music, there was only really a couple different types of music, but I mean, there were so many things happening and just so many things that they were discovering and you know, pondering and just, it was crazy how primitive we were, yet how much more classy and sophisticated we were. I don't know. It's kind of the ultimate conundrum right there. So anyway, I go see this movie because it's a period piece, and I'm thinking, ah, cool, you know, and I'm going to cut Angelina some slack. She sucked the last few films. You know, I'm going to give her some slack. Maybe she might be a little bit better. She seems to do better with the whole, you know, period kind of stuff. So I go see this, and you're getting into it, and you're watching it, and it really draws you in because, you know, I'm not going to give you this whole big review of the movie, but it draws you in because it gives you the period. It gives you the, you know, you have the dark settings. You have the off-putting camera shots. I mean, you have, you know, the dialogue is actually excerpted. It's excerpted. Okay, yeah, whatever. It's taken from let's just go right there, guys. Cut to the chase. So it's taken actually from transcripts of the court trials that happened back then, of the actual stuff. So I was reading about this, and I was just absolutely fascinated when I got done watching this movie. But they actually took, you know, the real documentation, the real things they said, and actually put it right in the dialogue. So a lot of the stuff that you hear in Changeling was actually said, was actually told. I mean, there was witnesses that came forward, you know, and you know, attested to the validity of it for the script. Incredible, incredible stuff, guys. So I'm watching, it's amazing. Like I said, I mean, it's very off-putting. It's, the pacing is really weird because you're not sure what you're watching. You know, are you watching just a typical kidnapping movie? Are you watching a period piece? You know, it's a true story. It doesn't say based on a true story. They're telling you the true story. So you're like, okay, well, what am I seeing? What's happening? You're trying to decipher this, right? And you're falling into it. And I had heard some nasty reviews about Angelina in this film. And I think people just need to, you know, stop for a second and take the whole thing in. Let's not dissect Angelina's performance, because really, was she far off from depicting how women of that era were? They were, you were supposed to have a demeanor. You were supposed to be subtle. You were supposed to not talk. You were supposed to be quiet. You know, you didn't have ideas. You know, this was still a time when women's rights, you know, we were trying to get moving. We were trying to get things popping. So, I mean, really, a lot of people said, oh, well, her son went missing and she didn't react properly. Really? Look at the time period. I mean, I don't know. I cut her a lot of slack on that, guys, because it didn't detract me from the film. If her performance had detracted me, I might have said something, but it didn't, guys. So, you know, I'm not sure where to go with this. Her son goes missing. It's this whole thing. The police are in on it. They end up, you know, they're basically a laughing stock, the LAPD. They're trying to, like, recoup some of their integrity. So they find this boy who says he is her son, and they're like, oh, okay, cool. You know, we're going to show it in the papers. We're going to get press that LAPD actually can do things, that we're actually, you know, we're looking out for our people. We're this, we're that, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, they bring the mother, whose name was Christine Collins, to her supposed son, Walter Collins, and she goes right away, this isn't my son. And the cops are like, yeah, it is. You're just in shock. You know, you're just in shock. He's been through a big deal. You know, you haven't seen him for months. It's him. And she's like, no, I know my son. That's not my son. And basically, and this was really sad. This is actually in transcripts from 1928. They actually said, the cop actually told her, just take him home and try him out. I promise it's your son. So, of course, she's, you know, disillusioned. And, I mean, the woman had gone through a harrowing experience. You know, she's been fighting to find her son. You know, she's been distraught. So, I mean, obviously, I don't blame the woman for just saying, you know, this was supposed to be a law, you know, an official of the law. This was supposed to be somebody that back then you trusted and you looked up to and you said, okay, and yes, sir, and I'll follow what you say. So, of course, she takes the kid home. 3 weeks later, she brings him back and says, okay, yeah, I did it. He's not my son. And basically they said, well, you're being obstinate and you're being an opinionated woman, so we're going to take you and throw you in the county psychiatric hospital. Did that, didn't bother the whole time to keep finding her son or admit they made a mistake or admit, hey, we screwed up. This kid isn't, he's some other kid that pretended to be her son. Sorry, our bad, you know, let's try to fix this. No, they just kept spiraling out of control. So anyway, the whole movie is basically about her, about this mother's struggle for her son. And the screenwriter, who is actually a journalist, had said that he thought that was the most heartfelt part about the case, was that here's this mother who went through hell and back for her son, and she never gave up. He said that how many of us even remember this story? How many of us even knew about this story? You know, and he said many more should know about her bravery, her sacrifice, what she was willing to go through for her boy to get her boy back, you know, a mother's love. So, and I'll be honest, I've never heard of this story before. And it has one of my favorite aspects in it, and I never even heard of it. It's crazy, guys. So anyway, we're getting to the good stuff. So she goes through all this stuff, and she has a local, you know, preacher who has a radio show trying to help her out and trying to, you know, he's fighting against the injustices of the police and stuff like that. So anyway, there's a little subplot mixed in here, and you kind of get thrown for a minute, but then you're trying to peek through, and you're like, what am I seeing? Okay, what's happening here? Turns out, guys, and this is a real story, this is a true story, nobody knows exactly what happened to her son, but around the same time, there was a man named Gordon Stewart Northcott, who was a serial killer, and he committed what is known as the Wineville Chicken Coop Murders. He kidnapped a bunch of boys. The numbers, nobody knows for sure, because he would admit it, deny it. But anyway, he basically killed these kids, brought them to his farm in Wineville, and locked them in the chicken coop and would cut them up with axes. I mean, he sexually abused them. He would cut them up with axes. He held his nephew from Canada hostage and was sexually abusing him and made him help him commit these crimes, help him murder this. And his nephew was like 15 at the time, made him do all this stuff and kill these kids. So anyway, I mean, they're just, the tales were outrageous. And at this time, everyone was like, oh my God. So they go through all these trials and everything, and they really tap into this Northcott guy, but in a sort of off-putting way. He's not the main focus of the story. Here's this horrendous serial killer who is real. This really happened. And you're given, like, this true crime story. You're given this other aspect. You're given this emotional mother aspect. You're completely thrown off. You get, like, five stories for one, guys. And I thought it was awesome. So here I'm finding, and I love serial killers. So here I am loving period pieces. I'm loving the drama. I'm loving the buildup, the pacing. I'm loving Eastwood's direction. I'm loving the way that, you know, he's you know, appropriating for camera. I'm loving everything. And then they throw a serial killer in. Okay, now I'm hooked. Now it's great, right? So they go on, and they end up showing what really happened. They captured the guy. They brought him in. He denied he killed anybody. And basically, Christine Collins is like, did you kill my son? Did you take my son? Well, at first, Stanford Clark, the nephew, you know, who admitted to the murders and got his uncle caught, said, you know, yeah, I think he's one of the boys we took. You know, I'm pretty sure. Well, then of course, Northcott said, no, we didn't take that, you know, boy, because Walter Collins was a huge thing. His mother was going up against the LAPD. His mother was causing a stir for the injustice that was caused. So Walter Collins and Christine Collins was a huge thing in the papers. So Northcott had seen her face and had recognized her and was saying, no, I didn't kill your son. Then he said, well, maybe, I don't know. And I mean, it was just back and forth, this poor woman. Anyway, she went up against the LAPD. She won, which actually was the single breaking point for the police department. They started to get investigated. People started to get kicked out, started to get demoted. That's when things started to get cleaned up, which really I think we could use in about every state right now. But I'm not going to get into that, especially since I'm sure the cops are still looking for me. But after the 4th of July incident with the headlights. But whatever. So moving on. Catch me if you can, fucker. So anyway, I mean, it was fascinating, this wine coop murder thing. I was like completely like thrown, like I had no idea this was in here. And then I started to wonder, this is a true story, but is this Northcott guy real? Like, did they invent this? I'm not sure. I don't remember him. I mean, there's hundreds, thousands of serial killers around the world, and I know the majority of them escaped me, could not remember this for the life of me. So I watched the rest of this movie, and it turns out great. There's a positive message. I mean, you feel really bad because, you know, the mother never knew what happened to her son. One of the kids that supposedly was killed on the ranch ended up being found 5 years later. He said he was afraid to come home. He had escaped the ranch. He said that Walter Collins was there, was one of the prisoners with him. But there was only fragments of bodies found. No one no one was truly identified. There was only 3 kids identified when there was over 20 that were missing. So, I mean, it was just, it was remarkable, a remarkable story, guys. But I got home, right? And I mean, I'm absolutely floored because I'm like, wow, I expected this movie to blow. And this movie rocked. I was like, this was a great film. And I love films about true crime. I love it. You know, you get into the serial killer thing, you get into the whole mode. This is what really happened. This is what was really said. These were real people. I love the 20s. You know, this happened in 1928. You know, Northcott was executed in 1930. It was insane. So I come home, and I go through all my encyclopedia serial killers. Sure enough, Gordon Stewart Northcott was in them, guys. He did do it. I was floored even more. I was like, you have got to be kidding me. This rocked. I was thrown in front of a serial killer and didn't even know it. Oh, my God, this is awesome. So I was just absolutely floored, and I loved the story. I loved everything about it. I highly, highly recommend it. I think it's a great movie. If you're into movies about explosions and TNA, sorry, guys, shouldn't go see it because you require at least half a brain cell to watch this type of movie. But I'm going to say it again. I love Eastwood as a director. He was a great actor, but I absolutely love him as a director. He is such a good director at psychological drama. I don't know. I mean, action, okay, he's got his moments, but man, I mean, I don't know anybody that can really get in there. I mean, as far as modern directors, and yeah, we have some that give us some good stuff, but man, he really has some great stuff. And like I said, Mystic River, I mean, I love that movie. I love this stuff. It's just incredible. So I got to give him props for being a great director. But seriously, this Northcott guy, man, he was nuts. And like, I'm watching him, and I looked at the guy in the movie, and I was like, wow, this guy's really doing a great job. I mean, he's sadistic, he's crazy, you know, he's kind of got the Heath Ledger thing of being psycho going on, you know, just saying weird stuff and giving this really goofy, like, farmer boy smile. I mean, it was nuts. I go home, and I look at a picture of him. I'll be damned if the casting director didn't cast somebody that looked just like him. I had a chill, man. I was like, oh, my God. Anyway, when the SOB got hung for, you know, killing and mutilating all those poor boys' bodies, when he finally got hung on October 2nd, 1930, and Christine Collins and some of the mothers were there to watch, he was scared to death. Actually went up to the thing crying, pleading for help, and oh no, somebody say a prayer for me. I don't want to go to hell. I don't want to go to hell. I'm like, really? You're scared of hell? I mean, you've been butchering people, basically eating carcass. I was like, you really care? Like, I don't understand that when these serial killers are like, I don't want to go to hell. Why do you even care? Where? I think you passed that point a long time ago. It doesn't matter anymore. It really doesn't. So I just thought it was wow, guys. And That's why I had to talk about it. And I don't care that I spend, 10, 15 minutes talking about it, because it's an incredible movie and it has the serial killer twist. And I love true crime and I love the 1920s, 1930s period pieces. I mean, the serial killer, though, this is fascinating. I had never heard of the Wine Coop Chicken Murders or Wine Coop, the Wineville Chicken Coop Murders. I never heard of that. That was awesome. And I actually felt derelict in my serial killer hobby for not knowing this. But wow. All I got to say is wow about that. That was great. The guy's nuts. And I don't know. It was crazy. And he even went as far as inviting Christine Collins to his jail cell on the eve of his execution, which he went to San Quentin, and no woman was allowed there for like the last 30 years to visit a serial killer on the eve of his execution. And he went, or she went, because he sent her a telegraph that said, I lied before. I want to come clean about your boy. So she goes there hoping for closure, and all he said was, as soon as he faced her, he's like, oh, I don't want to do this. I don't want to see you right now. No, I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, can you imagine that woman? God, I would have just clocked him, seriously. So, I don't blame her. And to the day she died, she never knew what happened to her son. She never knew if he was alive. She never knew, where, what happened. And I had read somewhere that if he is still alive today, if somehow he escaped the ranch, somehow he was like the other boy, afraid to come home, afraid that this person would be looking over, he'd have to look over his shoulder every day if this person be there. He'd be 80 years old today, guys. And I believe he was 9 when he was abducted. So, wow, just incredible stuff. But I just got to say that movie rocks, and I think people should go see it. Incredible directing. The psychology behind it, the pacing is amazing. And he's so good at appropriating the camera and knowing where it is and being constantly aware of its position. And, just the cinematography was great for the period. I have to give shout out to the prop guys, the costume guys. You did a great job for reenacting that. I was like, wow, that's a lot of, a lot of 1920s period cars. I've never seen so many in my life. I didn't even know they existed. So good stuff with that. So I just got to give a round of applause to those guys. And I don't know, that Northcott guy, seriously, you need to go see it just to see how twisted that guy is. And I don't know, I'm just, it sticks with you. The serial killers stick with you. They do. Because it's something you wouldn't normally do in your everyday life, but you know it's inside you. And we have the suppression mechanism to say, no, we're not going to do that. But, man, to watch what these people do, it's fascinating. It's like a car crash. You don't want to look, but you're like, ooh, what's happening? It's crazy. It's crazy, guys. Anyway, we're going to go to commercial because I've been babbling on, but you know me, I love serial killers. So, and of course, you guys just got an official review from Gore Girl, so take it and chew on it if you want. But we're going to go to commercial. When we come back, guys, we're going to have Rob Dunbar, author of The Pines, about the New Jersey Devil. Stay tuned.
And now a word from our sponsors.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honeybees and snow white turtle doves.
I'd like to teach the world to sing with me.
Irony. We just got done talking about serial killers and changeling to buying the world a Coke. I don't know. That's sort of the twisted macabre things that happen here on the Gore Girl Variety Hour. You have a little serial killer, you have a little world harmony, it all goes hand in hand. I don't know. Jumping down a hill with your acoustic guitar, holding Jeffrey Dahmer in hand in hand. I don't know. It's crazy. So anyway, guys, we have a special treat for you. I am excited to have him on. This is incredible stuff. We're making history here. This guy's amazing. Let me bring on the one and only author of The Pines, Rob Dunbar. Hey, Rob, you there?
Hey, how are you?
So, like that little intro? Did I sort of segue it all right for you?
Yeah. Well, I got all excited. I thought it was an obscene phone call.
Yeah, see, it was. I don't know.
We're
going to have a half an hour of sort of obscene gestures.
Did you make it too?
Yeah, I actually am. I'm in a towel. And So how's it going, Rob? What have you been up to lately?
Oh, well, you know, writers have the most boring lives in the world. All I do is work.
Well, I have to ask you, because I'm sure some of the fans out there, what is your specific type of genre of writing? What is it that you do best?
Oh, honey, I do horror.
Yeah.
I've written everything. I've written poetry. I've given poetry readings. My poetry has won awards. I've written plays that have been produced and even published, and plays have won awards, but they never make any money. And I've worked in radio. I've worked in television. I've written a lot of television shows, hundreds and hundreds of television shows. Nothing anyone in their right mind has ever seen, of course. But you know, I always said they could pay me to write this stuff, but they could never pay me enough to watch it. You know,
right.
But then I found myself. I write horror, and people love it. I found my niche.
And you said you have a boring life. I disagree, because if you're a horror author, come on, you get to delve into that subconscious. You get to be psychotic.
Oh, well, yeah, there's all kinds of crazy, violent, apocalyptic things going on in my skull as I sit at the computer typing away.
And now a word of caution, kids. We're entering Rob's mind.
Uh-oh. So, abandon all hope.
Yes, I know. And it's downhill from here. Everything's on fire. It's gone. Well, I have to say, my God, The Pines. What an amazing novel. I mean,
and
we've seen the reviews. You know, people have said, what a great, prolific horror author you are. And you're one of their favorite horror authors ever. And I just... Wow, I think it's amazing.
The reviews have been just amazing. I mean, I'm still just blown away every day.
I think you are an amazing author, and of course, I'm a big fan of horror, and it really takes a lot to get me going. But wow, I'd have to say you have such a great style, and I actually wrote a really nice
praise from the master here.
I know,
Sabrina the Gore Girl, like.
Yes, you're talking to somebody.
I'm pushing your buttons. I take it.
That has a name, a stage name. I don't know. Somebody had asked me once. They're like, "What?" Speaking of macabre things, they're like, "Well, what's the difference between you and Gore Girl?" I'm like, I don't know. I refer to her in third person. Does that make me nuts? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a little scary, actually.
Here's some material for you. Just that's a whole thing we don't want to get into, and nudity and.
You never know who's listening. You know.
No. So the Pines. Now, tell me, what was the inspiration for this?
Well, I grew up around that whole area, which is, it's an amazing and still a very alien kind of landscape. And we're talking over a million acres of this weird dwarf pine forest. I think Atlantic Magazine in the mid-1800s referred to it as a region aboriginal in savagery. And it really hasn't changed all that much. It's still very harsh and very, very remote. And it's in the middle of the most highly industrialized state in the Union. But the industrial centers are all around this enormous forest. And if you drive off the road, you're in the middle of nowhere. I mean,
it's
got all these wonderful, deserted-looking, scary houses. And it's like, oh, let's see, Jason lives in that one. That's Count Dracula's summer place over there. And
Frankenstein,
chopped
there,
totally,
sunbathed
totally,
over there. It was great. No, I mean, your book centers around the legend of the Jersey Devil. I mean, people have been eating this up for years. Cryptozoologists have gone insane with it. What is it? You grew up in that area. What is it that you grew up hearing?
Well, it's funny. The first time I really went camping in the Pine Barrens as an adult, I had totally forgotten those stories that I'd heard as a kid. They were part of the fabric of my childhood, but I had totally lost them. And of course, we got lost in the Pine Barrens, which is the first thing anybody does when they get to the Pine Barrens, and it is just what the whole place is there for. And I had a classic horror movie setup. The car broke down. I sprained my ankle trying to hike back to the farmhouse. We were going to call for help, and they were like, "Okay." My friends were like, "Okay, you wait with the car," and I'm like, "Okay." Now, when this happens in a horror movie.
Right.
That's the first person who gets it, you know? You know the zombies are coming immediately.
I'll wait right here for the evil that's coming around the corner.
Yeah, of course. And waiting with the car, and my friends went and found somebody, and they came back, and they got the tow and all that. But waiting with the car, I remembered all of the stories. But I remembered them kind of distorted, the way, you know, kids remember things, the way kids absorb things. And I did a lot of research afterwards because I got really hooked. I scared myself witless, actually, sitting there waiting in the car, sitting remembering all these stories about this presence in the woods, and you could really feel it. I mean, the wind would, you know, blow through these pine trees and make this kind of howling, mournful noise. I'm like, yeah, there's a monster here, no question. You know?
I'm going to die. It's Blair Witch 35.
Oh, absolutely. Totally. You know, it's a... which I think I swear was probably based on Jersey Devil, but I did a lot of research, and it turns out this is one of the oldest oral myth traditions in America, and it goes and it's a classic kind of Brothers Grimm sort of, you know, old dark cabin in the middle of the woods, and there's a mother Leeds is pregnant with her 13th kid, and she doesn't want it. You know, now you may find it a little difficult to find it in your heart to condemn her for this, but
right.
She does something unforgivable, and she curses the child. She says, "Let it belong to the devil." Actually, there's another version where what she says is actually, "It does belong to the devil." In other words, it's the devil's child. Now, this was just a few years after the Salem witch hunts. So you have to understand, people really believe that. They believe she could have been consorting with devils. Anyway, she has, you know, the story goes on. It's the requisite old, dark, you know, stormy night, and the wind is howling, and the lightning is flashing, and she gives birth to the baby. And in some versions, it's perfectly normal, and then within a few seconds, it warps into some kind of little demon and flies around the cottage and up the chimney and goes off, and it's haunting the woods. But in other versions, it's this monstrously deformed thing, and she keeps it hidden and takes care of it until she's old and feeble, and it breaks free into the woods, and it's been whatever version you embrace,
right.
out there lurking in the
there's
woods.
There's so many
for hundreds of years.
So many different tales, you know, coming to combine the Jersey Devil, and afterwards the scores of sightings, and you know, people were staying out of the woods, and you know, chickens were missing, and dogs.
There have been riots.
I'm like, oh my God, what's happening? And then, you know, of course you hear the whole thing about 1909 when they had all the big sightings and everything, and you're like, oh.
You really researched this, absolutely. That's the hot year, 1909.
Right.
Literally hundreds of sightings.
It's fascinating. Like you said, it's one of the oldest oral traditions, but I mean, it's interesting to see how society is built, you know, on a fear, how we sort of go from fear to fear, and this like formulates how our society functions, what we stay away from, what we improve on. It's just, it's fascinating to see the different things.
Absolutely. I think folklore is a vastly underrated kind of litmus test for where the culture is. You know, you can find out so much more about a people from what their superstitions were,
right?
Than you can from studying the historical documents, because the superstitions really give you the key to their psychology.
It's I don't know. I just always thought the Jersey Devil was an amazing thing, and of course, some obscenely odd fact that, you know, it's still in pop culture today because we have the New Jersey Devils hockey team. So.
Of course, yeah. Oh, hockey team. Everything's Jersey Devils. Everything. There are bands. There are magazines.
The X-Files.
There are video games.
Well, see, actually, that's what I was going to ask you. Now, is this the whole Jersey Devil story when you were a kid, is this what got you into horror? Like, what surged you into, you know, the surreal horror that you...
Well, it's like, I was a huge horror fan, but I was never... I was never a fan of the pop horror. I was a fan of the classic horror, the classics. I loved writers like Algernon Blackwood and Shirley Jackson, who wrote The Haunting of the House, and you know, literate writers who wrote beautiful novels that also happened to scare the hell out of you. You know,
exactly.
Henry James, Turn of the Screw sort of thing. And,
oh, my God.
And, of course, you know, I loved Dracula and Frankenstein. But all of the great classics are based on European myth. You know, there was this huge belief in vampires in Central Europe, and Frankenstein comes right out of the belief in the golem, you know. But the there had been nothing really based on American folklore, and I was racking my brains trying to come up with a topic for a horror novel that would be really quintessentially American. And I was going through all these Indian legends and ghost stories from the African American slaves, and all the stuff is so sad.
That's probably the most depressing thing possible.
They're just heartbreaking stories. But then I found the Jersey Devil, and it's this absolutely terrifying belief in this monster, and it's very strongly believed in to this day in the Pine Barrens. I can't do a lecture in a library or a historical society without, you know, dozens of people coming up to me afterwards to tell me about, you know, the time it chased them and the time it was on the roof of their house.
Right.
And
the snow prints and the, oh my God, my neighbor's dog's throat was ripped out.
Oh, totally, totally. Yeah, and everybody's mother has. I did a call-in show in outside of Atlantic City where this woman called in and told me, you know, her mother had been the original midwife that delivered the Jersey.
What?
Well, your mom has to be at least 400 years old.
Oh my God.
I'm sure she looks great for her age.
What is she taking and where can we get some? Oh my God. I hope you laughed. I mean, I would have cracked up. I would have lost it. I've been like, oh my God, that's great. I need you on the show. What's, you know, your mom's like 400 years old. I need her on the show. Is she able to speak? What's happening? Can you just move her jaw or something?
You can't find anybody in the Pine Barrens that isn't related to the Jersey Devil. They're all so proud of it. There's still, you know, there's the town of Leeds Point is still there, and there's still lots of, you know, Leedses in the area. And every time I do a little television show, talking, you know, they keep wanting to send me out to the Pine Barrens with the camera crew, and I'm like, oh, that never gets old. Sure, let me just go out there with all the bugs.
86,432. Thanks. So, I mean, this is the Pine just took off. I mean, it's like a cult classic now. It's creepy. I mean, people read it. They read it like they read Blatty's The Exorcist. You know, with lights on and just in fear of noises outside their window. So I just thought that was fantastic, and it's been reissued. I mean, this is great. I mean, what do you?
Well, that's what's really exciting for me, because the first time it was published in a very butchered version. The editor.
Don't you just love editors?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's nothing. You know, there is no monster that's as scary as an editor with an axe to grind. You know, it's like there's nothing gets your blood creeping as well as intensely.
Editors, producers. I mean, the producers won't let me gnaw on things during the show, and you know, mind your P's and Q's.
People. Yeah.
Like God, fine, all right. No.
Well, you get it. You totally get it. It was just cut to pieces. It was really just cut to ribbon. And it still managed to get amazingly good reviews, but it was never the book I intended.
Right.
It was just a shadow of what I wanted it to be, and it's been restored now. So it's much longer and it's much deeper, and people are just going nuts over it. I mean, you're seeing all kinds of reviews of the, this has been my favorite book for years, but oh my God, I had no idea it was this. I'm like, well, good for you. That's exactly the response I wanted.
It's even more twisted than I thought, and I'm
exactly
loving it.
This is even sicker.
Well, I had heard somebody say something along the lines of, they were reviewing your book, and they had said, you know, I thought this was fabulous, it was brilliant, and I couldn't put it down, but I just wasn't a fan of how Clive Barker-ish the violence was. I'm like, what? What?
Yeah,
what?
Yeah. This is a criticism. It reminded me of Clive Barker. Uh-huh. Okay.
Like,
if that's the worst thing you can say about my writing,
right?
Say it.
I'm like this, and I'm looking at this like, this is bad. How this makes me want to order 10 more copies? What are you talking about? You know, I don't know. Sort of the Bible thumpers, you know, they probably belonged in the Pine Barrens, but who knows? So I had heard this, okay, and being totally, you know, being a variety hour, trying to bring back the old Baldville type feel, you know, what is this Bats that you had done and this horror hosting?
Oh, Bats was a hysterical play. When I was first doing the book tour for The Pines, I was on I did a whole lot of television shows that were basically in time slots calculated to, you know, to miss all the viewing audience, you know.
Right.
But we did one, there was a show called, honest to God, Saturday Night Dead. It would come on right after Saturday Night Live. So it started 1 o'clock in the morning, and they would run.
Was this New Jersey or where was it?
Actually, it was in Philadelphia, though. It was shown through the whole New Jersey area. It was shown to the whole tri-state area, the Delaware Valley. And the host was this gorgeous redhead. And her character, the actress was named Karen Scioli, and the character was Stella, the man-eater from Manayunk. Manayunk is a Philadelphia neighborhood. So she would run these really, really bad but fabulous old horror movies and do skits between the, you know, for the commercial break. She and her gang of zanies would do skits based on the films they were screening, and they didn't usually have guests on to be interviewed. But she read the book and loved it, and they invited me on the show, and I had the best time of my life on the show. With these loons.
That's the awesome part of horror. Seriously, like that's part of our roots that I love. It's the campy, it's the schlocky,
it's the
zany. I mean, you just love it. You love it because it's fantastic, you know? It's insane.
There's a whole tradition in Philadelphia because this is where the horror hosts were born. The first host was Zachary, John Zachary.
God.
And he moved, and then he took his show to New York, and then we had, before Elvira, there was Vampira, and so, you know, Stella was just the last great horror host in Philadelphia.
And that's just, it's awesome, because, I mean, Zachary, I mean, how many of us drooled over our Famous Monsters of Filmland mags, you know, over articles about Zachary, and oh my God, and we did a whole piece about, you know, Vampira and the significance she had. I mean, God, look at that. I mean, now you're officially part of horror history. Do you see how that works?
I think Zachary's even still kicking, isn't he? Like, I think he's 100 years old. He's still showing up at horror conferences.
Right. He's like, who's that? Me? The iron lung. Oh, that's Zachary. It's still frightening. I don't know.
Anyway, the show ran for, I think, 8 years, and actually won an Emmy, won a Mid-Atlantic Emmy, and Karen and I became great friends, and after that one day, I used to just come to when they were shooting. Even if I wasn't supposed to be on, I would just be there. I would just show up.
Okay, what's going on?
So I was on a lot, and if I wasn't there, on the set, the phone would ring, and she'd pick it up and pretend she was talking to me. We had so much fun. And when the show went off the air, I wrote a play for her about a B-movie horror actress who's you're going through her different stages of her life and her career, and you're in and out of the horror movies she's making, and she ends up a horror movie hostess at the end, screening one of her own films. the play was all, and there were bats flapping across the stage and fog machines blasting and cobwebs. And
oh my God! You know what that
was? Great, campy fun. We had such a ball with it.
It reminds me of you remember the Carol Burnett show when she did Nora Desmond?
Oh, of course. Of
oh,
course.
God.
Oh,
oh, God.
Oh, God.
It's awesome.
It was so Norma Desmond.
Is Bats still running? Is it?
No, Bats did very well. It's had about four different productions, and it's won a couple of awards. It was published in a theater magazine. It was published in book form. I can't imagine any other actress doing it, and I think if I were to, you know, to tell Karen that we're doing Bats again, she'd probably pull a gun on me. it's a one-woman show. She's the only, you know, the only human on. She plays eight different characters, but she's the only person on. And basically, the play was designed to drive an actress insane. After every production, she would just go into total collapse.
Really, just like
there may be another production someday, but I can't imagine who's going to do it. To find somebody who's got that many incredibly funny characters in her will be a real task.
And I had heard of Bats, and I had read stuff about it, but I never got the privilege to see it. And that's a shame, because I'm like, you're talking about it. And I'm like, come on, let's just stage one at your house. Let's go. What are you doing?
That's it, yeah. I still have all the props. We use them every Halloween. The severed hams and the gargoyles.
Oh, God. I don't know. Call Karen up. Let's go. We're going to do it tonight. We're a stage one, an amateur one. God, I mean, that's incredible. And see, I don't know if people realize just how, you know, like Bats and the Pines, just how affiliated and just how much a part of horror. And yeah, really, you are a part of horror history, because, I mean, you've helped to keep the camp going and to keep, you know, the little psychology of our roots going. I mean,
well, I don't know that we kept it going, but I think we certainly worked it.
You did. See, we're missing too much of that in mainstream horror now.
Yeah, it is too serious these days, isn't it?
Where's the passion?
I'll tell you what. You direct the movie.
I'm down. Let's do it. I would say, have you guys been approached about doing a movie for Bats?
People get interested in it every so often, and just as they keep getting interested in the Pines, but when they actually discover how crazy it is, they recoil in horror when they realize how intensely fun, and Bats is also just filthy.
It's like, you know, well, look at what happened when Rocky Horror Picture came out. People were repulsed, like, oh my God, that's alternative. We don't like that. I mean, God, you know, I mean, and look how incredible it is. You know,
And it only has the most devoted cult following.
Oh my God,
world,
does it not? I'm not opposed to dressing up on midnights and going to see it, so I'm not gonna say much. But I mean, what is okay? Now everybody knows the Pines, and what's the basic story of the Pines for those that have not seen or read it?
The basic plot of the novel. Well, it's not really about the Jersey Devil, although it uses the legend as a kind of a backdrop. It uses the fact that there are people out there who still believe in the legend. And it's about a woman who lives in your classic old dark house out there, and she's a widow, and she's raising her disturbed young son, who may not, as it turns out, be as disturbed as everyone thinks. I mean, his delusions may be true. He may actually be in a kind of union with something that lives out in the woods.
Oh my God.
His imaginary friend may not be imaginary enough.
Right.
And I'm a big practitioner of method writing. I scare the hell out of myself while I'm working. So if I give myself goosebumps, I've got a pretty good idea that I'm scaring my reader.
That's the only way to go.
Absolutely.
I mean, I tell everybody, because there's so many people that write or that direct or make movies, you know, based on what other people think. And I'm like, write it as it would scare you. Live it, you know, put it out there. What do you want to see in a movie? Because chances are, you're going to have about 50,000 other people that are like, yep, that's exactly what I wanted. So, okay, so now you have this incredible novel. It's being reissued. It's finally restored to your, you know, vision of what it was.
Very gratifying, very exciting for me.
And now you've got a sequel.
And the sequel will be out just before the summer. It's called The Shore. And, of course, in New Jersey, you've got the two big areas are the Pines, this huge forest, and everyone refers to the seacoast as The Shore. And it moves the action from the woods to a little dying resort town in the dead of winter. There's nothing in the world quite as dismal or depressing as a resort town off season.
Right.
There's nothing like snow on the beach for real creepiness and real isolation.
There's nothing like playing off misery.
Oh yes.
a little Jack Torrance in there. So I mean, are there any characters from, you know, the first book?
Oh yes. Although I probably shouldn't you know, tell you which ones, because they're a surprise.
God, I'm going to be chomping into that. I'm going to be emailing you every day. So what's up? What's happening? Where's this book? Don't keep me waiting. Don't keep me.
We'll try and get you an advanced copy.
We'll
get you a reviewer's copy.
Yes. I'll be like, yay. I'll be calling you up. Yeah, and I just crap myself. Thanks. Thank you. No, but I mean, I think it's incredible. So you're pretty much staying with the whole psychology in this one of how you are with the Pines, you know, basically throwing your audience into this surreal, you know, fantasy, like basically telling them, well, this is what really happens. This is the fear. Guess what? You're going to get to walk through it.
Right, except that I use a completely different kind of mood, because the Pines is you could practically you feel itchy when you're reading the Pines. There's mosquitoes. It's humid. It's hot. There are bugs everywhere, and it's the sweltering, you know, moist kind of setting. And in the, of course, in the shore, it's the dead of winter. It's freezing cold. It's very quiet, and they're very isolated. And there a winter storm kind of traps the people that in this little town, and you realize that there's something trapped with them. So it's a very different, the Pines is so explosively, apocalyptically violent, whereas the shore it tightens up, and it's a very isolated, very trapped kind of fear.
Now, see, I think that you should just put that in a shirt and wear that all the time.
Okay.
That sentence. I don't know. That just, to me, that like sums it up. Like,
there's a fashion statement for
you. Bob, he's a apocalyptic doom, and then he tightens up. I don't know.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah, you know.
Great.
There you go. Well, you know.
That's
all, you know.
Yeah, that's probably the most apt way to describe it is what I would say. But, okay, so what, I'm dying now. You're killing me with all this great stuff you have going on. What's Martyrs and Monsters?
Oh, you know about Martyrs and Monsters. That's the one that's just most recently been announced, and it's actually the one that's going to be out next. It'll be out probably just about end of February, beginning of March, from a little publisher called Dark Heart Press. And the
Dark Heart, right?
Actually, it's Dark Heart with an H-A-R-T, like a deer rather than a little beating heart. But the other publisher, because it's Leisure Books, is doing The Pines and the Shore. Now, Martyrs and Monsters is a collection of my short fiction, and I'm very excited about this. It's some of my best work, and everyone who's looked at it has been blown away. So I'd be very curious to hear how you react to it. It's very intense, a little erotic, but it's also extremely literary. And the stories range from horror to fantasy to science fiction to suspense, and there is a theme, but it's a kind of a theme of martyrdom and redemption and the kind of romantic sexual tension between the monster and the monster's love. You know, the hunchback always has the gypsy girl. The phantom always has the diva. So there's
the serial killer always gets a wife. I don't get it, but it's okay. I'm excited about Martyrs and Monsters because that's incredible. That's the exact type of short fiction I love, is just the stuff that gets in there. I mean, it's just long enough to pull you in and just, you know, stir your brain to a thick froth, but then it releases you immediately and you're like, oh my God, you know, you don't know where to go. You're spinning. So I absolutely love that type of horror.
It's the beautiful cover. It's this sort of naked, muscular demon, like emerging from the flames, and it's very sexy and very intense.
So I'm basically, what you're telling me is I'm going to read Martyrs and Monsters. I'm going to be fascinated. I'm going to fall on my seat with excitement, and then there's going to be just a puddle underneath me.
Yeah, that's it.
I think it's incredible. I think that's exactly. I like
you got
my,
it exactly. Yes.
I like my horror moist. It's fine. Well, thank you, Rob. We have come to the end of our time here, but my God, it's been a blast having you on.
Oh, so much fun. Thank you so much.
It's like, I love talking to you because you just get it. You get what horror is. You get what it's about. You're in it. You're living it. You're breathing it. It's. I love it. I love you.
Who
I love
talked?
It. Yeah, I love all of it. I love all of it. It's great. But thank you so much.
Next time we chat, I'll tell you all about this haunted house I'm living in.
Oh, my God. You didn't tell me that. Now I have to know. Okay, well, that's it. Where's my producer? Book him next week. We need this. I need to hear. You definitely come on, and I want you to come.
This was so much fun. Anytime.
Great. Well, where can people go to grab these books?
Well, Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. also just go to my website, and there are plenty of links to places that are selling the books. There's my website is www.dunbarauthor.com. Or
yes.
just Google The Pines, Robert Dunbar.
Yeah,
and you're right to my site.
I see, you know, and anybody that Googles, you know, Rob Dunbar, there's going to be some hot pictures, you know, you leaning up against the wall, you know, kind of like the little pouty face. It's hot. It's sexy.
Oh, yes, I am a joy to behold, yes.
Sexy. I was all over it. I was like, yes, yes, I got this.
Too funny.
Thank you so much for coming on. I love you, and I cannot wait for Martyrs and Monsters. Can't wait for the sequel of The Pines. I'm excited. I don't even know what to do. I can't contain it.
Me too.
I'm like stroking the mic in anticipation. This is exciting. You've just...
I knew this was an obscene phone call. I knew
it. It is. I lied to you. We're not doing a radio show. This is for my personal satisfaction. Thank you so much, Rob. And everybody out there, we will have links to his stuff so you can go pick up the books. Run, don't walk to pick up The Pines. It's incredible. I swear I'm not lying to you. But thank you, Rob, and we definitely have to have you on in the future.
Terrific. Anytime.
All right.
We'll talk.
Well, yeah, we'll do lunch. That's what we'll do. We'll do lunch.
There you go.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
Meet me in The Pines.
I don't know. I don't know.
Bye.
Bye, Rob. Thanks. Oh, God, guys. Well, guess what? We're going to go ahead and go to commercial while we clean up the puddle and salivating. So I don't know. Just
and
play
now
something.
A word from our sponsors.
Here's to good friends. Tonight is kind of special. The beer will pour. Must say something more somehow. So tonight, let it be low and brown.
Let it be low and brown.
It's been so long. Hey, I'm glad to see you. Raise your glass. Here's to health and happiness. So tonight, tonight, let it be all the best.
When you're with good friends having good times, don't just have a beer, have a Lowenbrau. Because good friends and good times deserve the taste of a great beer. And there's really only one, Lowenbrau.
Tonight, let it be Lowenbrau.
I don't know, guys. I don't know what's happening. I'm flashing back. That was awesome. Oh, my God. Producers, was that not awesome? Because the producers are nodding. Yes, bring Rob back on. Good interview. Gigi was tame. Didn't say F words. Good times. I don't know what you're talking about. Oh, my God, guys. That's awesome because that's totally the type of horror I'm into. I don't know. I'm not like some of these moviegoers, these people that, you know, they can't even read horror. They can't watch it. They can't read it if it has a little bit of intellectualism to it. To me, that's the worst kind. Yeah, you could have anybody pick up a machete and butcher you, but it's the intellectual stuff, you know. It's the stuff you have to wrap your brain around. It's the stuff that you actually have to ponder for a minute, you know, that's actually exciting. And I love it, you know. Seriously, William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist, that novel, everybody and their mother has seen the movie, which is the movie that actually got me into filmmaking, got me into, you know, the horror genre, made me realize, you know, that I was, you know, born to be of and about film, thus my horror hostess duties as Gore Girl and the appearances I make around the country at conventions. But seriously, that's, I don't know. William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist, read that. It's insane. I mean, the movie, it takes the movie to a whole nother level. If you were scared of the movie or you have this undying respect for the movie, read the book. I guarantee it will blow your socks off. And that's what, you know, that's exactly what Rob writes. That's exactly what his books are. That's what The Pines is. I mean, you know, the whole book is not like an encyclopedia about the Jersey Devil, but it's, you know, I love, like I said, the Changeling that we, or not the Changeling, but Changeling we watched has all these different elements to it, all these different stories. It's not one core story. Love it, guys. I love it. But anyway, we didn't go too much into the Jersey Devil, so I'm going to give you a little bit more of a background. I'm pretty sure you guys picked up on it. And I think, you know, it's one of those things. It's like Bigfoot. It's like Yeti. I'm going to bring Magnus Apollo on. He's actually a cryptozoologist, a good friend of mine. I love this guy. He's insane. He's nuts. And I'm going to bring him on to talk about the Bigfoot hunts he goes on and all the stuff that he's involved in. But he could tell you about the Jersey Devil. I mean, it's cryptozoology at its finest, guys. It's one of the mysteries of life, so to speak. But the Jersey Devil was like we were talking with Rob, a mythical creature in the New Jersey Pinelands. Supposedly it's haunted New Jersey in the area for the past 260 years. There's been seen by over 2,000 witnesses. I mean, there's been books made about it. There's been an X-Files episode about it. Cartoons were made about it. Video games fictionalize it. I mean, it's insane the reach it has. We have an NHL team named after the New Jersey Devil. So it's crazy. But, I mean, there's so many different stories, like he was saying, about the birth of the Jersey Devil. The one that he said, and I mean, they're saying that one of them was Mrs. Shrouds of Leeds Point, New Jersey, made a wish that if she ever had another child, she'd want it to be a devil. So the next night he was born, and he was mishapen and deformed. She kept him in the house. He escaped and supposedly runs around and haunts the woods. That's one version that Rob gave us. A young girl fell in love with a British soldier during the Revolutionary War. The people of Leeds Point cursed her. When she gave birth, she had a devil. Some people believe that it was punishment by the local church for the treatment of the town. Just insane stories, guys. They said that the typical story that everybody knows is that a Mrs. Leeds found out she was pregnant with her 13th child and shouted out during birth, "I hope it's a devil," or "I give this child to Satan," or "This child will be a devil." And what Rob said, that she had actually hinted that the father of the child was the devil. A lot of people in the time thought she was a witch. So, I mean, these are the stories. She was a witch that she, you know, she and Satan, you know, I don't know, did the horizontal polka, and all of a sudden she's, you like that? My producers are cracking up. I was trying to find something kind of odd to say, you know. I was like, what are, you know, not bumping uglies. What's an odd one? Horizontal polka works. You know, and there's so many different stories. There's different versions where they say it was the 6th, the 8th, the 342nd child. So, I mean, so many different things. But the legend, there's a couple things that all of the stories seem to have in common. The word Leeds. Every story, either the family's name is Leeds or they're from Leeds Point. The fact of, you know, where they were from, what, you know, the whole city area, the region that it happened, how it looked. This is the thing, is there's been a lot of descriptions about how the New Jersey Devil looked. There's drawings, there's depictions. There was a drawing that actually appeared in the newspaper in 1909. The majority of people say it's about three to 4 feet high. It has a head sort of like a dog head with the face of a horse. It has wings. It has huge legs, hind legs that, you know, sort of resemble a horse, a kangaroo. It has a long neck like a giraffe. And a lot of people say it has a tail that sticks straight out like a monkey. Some say it's got a forked tail. Some say it doesn't. I mean, these are the standard things that every eyewitness account has said. It's just insane stuff. And we were talking about the sightings themselves. I mean, there were so many sightings pre-1909, footsteps and, you know, missing livestock. But the biggest thing happened in 1909. On Sunday morning, January 16th, this man named Thack Cousins, saw a flying creature with glowing eyes flying down his street. Right away, this guy named John heard and saw the strange creature on the banks of a canal near his house. A patrolman fired at the creature as it flew away screaming. A minister saw the bird-like creature and heard its piercing screams. When daylight finally came around, people found hoof prints in the snow, the entire town. And the hoof prints, you know, were never like any animal they saw before. They were on rooftops. They were up trees. It was the same footprints. They would go in one direction, then mysteriously disappear as if it had taken flight. I mean, a lot of crazy stuff. And yeah, we could go with the whole mob mentality that, you know, one person saw this, so 15 other people heard something in the dark. And, oh my God, it's the Jersey Devil. Yeah, I mean, this stuff happens all the time. there's a murderer loose. Oh, I saw him over here. He was behind the jewel, you know, and it wasn't, you know, it's just a mob mentality where there's a fear circulating around and you get chunks of gossip and stories. So people feed off it. Oh yeah, I saw him. It was a dog, you know, but no, I saw the Jersey Devil, you know, he stole my dog, even though their dog just ran away. So, I mean, there's tons of things, and there's so much speculation, as in any cryptozoology, as in Bigfoot, as in the Yeti, as in, you know, Nessie. There's so many things, like theories on what it is, stories of eyewitness accounts, photographs, all sorts, everything's different. This is what I love about cryptozoology, is it's so many crazy stories and so many crazy things. And we were talking with Rob about how it shows the fear of a nation, how it shows how we as a people take our fears and form our societies off of our fears. So I just thought it was wild. I mean, and I mean, the Jersey Devil, and like Rob was talking about the Pine Barrens, that is such a desolate piece of land. It still is today. I was talking about the subconscious being an unexplored part, you know, that men have never discovered. The Pine Barrens is pretty close to it, guys. Just insane. And 1909, in this like week period of time, there was more sightings of the New Jersey Devil than anywhere else. It was insane, guys. The next Monday, this family found hoof prints in their yard around their trash that was half eaten. Like I was talking about, the prints all over the place. They organized hunts, but dogs wouldn't follow the trail. You know, this couple said they watched the New Jersey Devil out of their window for 10 minutes. They said that, you know, it was about 3 feet high with the face like a horse, and its back legs were like a crane, and it had hooves, and, you know, it had wings, and, you know, they were scared, but he yelled out the window, "Shoo!" And the thing barked at him and flew away. I mean, just so many, you know, the Mothman, this comes to mind, the Mothman. How many people had said that story that creeped me out about the Mothman was that family was inside their house, and they had saw somebody, like, lurking around their car, like, ducked down by their car out the window. And when they went to look out, the Mothman was standing on their front porch looking in their window, just staring at them. That freaked me out. I was like, oh, my God, that's a little creepy. You know, can you imagine that? That's a little nuts, guys. So, I mean, you know, stuff like this. They said that the Jersey Devil, I mean, livestock was missing. There's a lot of things, guys. There's a lot of theories, a lot of suspicion, a lot of conspiracy theories, such as, oh, what it was, where it came from, what its origins are. But there's a lot of things that happened then that cannot be explained. What about the footprints? The whole town had footprints. You know, they would disappear in the middle of nowhere. They would go up trees. They were on, like, rooftops. I mean, it was crazy. They couldn't explain it. There was an unprecedented amount of livestock missing. And, yeah, it could have been a wolf. It could have been a bear. But they knew what those footprints were. They know what a bear's footprint is. They know what a wolf's footprint is. So who knows? Maybe it's a rare species. And a lot of people, there's, you know, it was so much fear. They actually shut down schools because kids would not go to school. They actually shut down mills and factories because people were afraid to leave their houses, even in the daytime. This was during the 1909 thing. People refused to leave their houses because they were afraid they would be attacked by the Jersey Devil. People were seeing it everywhere. They'd see it flying in the air. They'd see it fly over their cars. A cab guy got out, was fixing his tire, and the thing landed on the roof of his car. He ran away. I mean, I don't know. That'd be the perfect, like, scam the pole if you want to jack cars. But, I mean, just insane stuff. And this is what I love. It's these stories. It's this mythology. It's this basis of fear that paralyzes us. I love this, guys. So, and of course, it wasn't like it was a bunch of drunks seeing it. There was police officers that saw it. There was ministers that saw it. You know, kids, wives, husbands, farmers, hunters. I mean, there was every make, model, and kind of people. Everybody saw this. And a lot of people described similar things. Is it the child of Satan? I don't know. I can't say for sure. That's one cool thing about being involved in the paranormal, is I don't have to say yes or no. But, you know, there's a lot of theories. One of them is that the Jersey Devil's a bird, that it's a scrowfoot duck, that it's a sandhill crane. Some people said that they thought it was a prehistoric animal from the Jurassic period, that it survived underground and came out. A lot of people agree, though, that it can't be one particular thing if it's a bird or something, because it's spanned over 300 years of sightings. So how could it be one thing? Unless it is supernatural and it's some guardian of hell or something, then I guess suppose. But, you know, there's theories that, you know, he was the deformed child of a woman that escaped into the woods, and then people misled what they saw and you know, were claiming it was a devil when it was just this deformed child. I mean, it doesn't explain the footprints and the flight. I mean, a lot of things aren't explained, and there's a lot of theories. I don't really know what to say about it, guys. It could be a hoax. It could not be a hoax. Who knows? Same thing with Bigfoot. Same thing with Yeti. I don't disbelieve, guys, until I see it for myself. I don't ever say, Yeti ain't real. What if it is? How many times they just found how many times they find species that we thought were extinct for like 80 years, and then they find a little family or a little colony of them somewhere. They just found, it was just on Yahoo yesterday, they found this little pygmy thing. It looks like a little like crazy looking gremlin. They found this. It was supposedly it was extinct for the last 50 years. They found like four of them. They caught them in a net somewhere in South America. And the one woman got bit by one because they got frightened and they tried to get away. The one researcher got bit, and she's like, I'm the only person in the world to have been bitten by a pygmy or whatever the hell it is. I mean, can you imagine? So who knows? What if this was a prehistoric creature? What if this was a rare species of bird that was never caught, you know, or that we assumed was never around or we never discovered? Who knows, guys? Or it could be the child of Satan. And, somebody had said something that they thought that it was the child of Satan because that he was the essence of evil, and that a devil is supposedly an uncanny harbinger of war. Supposedly, he appeared before the start of the Civil War. He was sighted before the Spanish-American War, before World War I. He was spotted in 1939 before World War II. He was seen right before Pearl Harbor. He was seen before the Vietnam War. So who knows? Is he the embodiment of evil, a harbinger of horrible things to come? He seemed to show up right before every war that we've been in as America. So I don't know, guys. I don't know. It's up to you what you want to think. I don't disbelieve anything. I say, hey, whatever. You know, if it's out there, cool. Gives us more crazy stuff to believe in. If it's a bird, cool. If it's some crazy deformed child that only lived 5 years, well, I feel bad for it, but cool. That's a good story. So I don't know, guys. I don't disbelieve anything, but there's a crazy thing, the Jersey Devil. And I don't know. You need to read Rob's book because it's chilling. It's a chilling book, guys. But, yeah, I don't know, the Jersey Devil. I thought everybody knew about the Jersey Devil. I thought everybody knew the story, the back history, but turns out a lot of people don't know. A lot of people didn't know about Mothman. I certainly didn't know until I got into the paranormal community. Now we have Mothman festivals, and we all go hunting for Mothman, and, you know, it's crazy. And I'll tell you one thing, though. When those bridges collapsed, what was it, 2 years ago now? When those bridges collapsed, everybody in the paranormal community was buzzing. I called Bonnie from Ghostly Talk. I'm like, Bonnie, bridges collapsed. Is it the Mothman? And she's like, I don't think so, Gore Girl. I don't think so. So thank you, and we love you, Bonnie. Anyway, I got to get on to something real fast. We only got like 7 minutes. I can't even believe it. Time flew by tonight. Anyway, we had an awesome interview there. But I got to do something here because this is awesome, and I didn't even know this. And we were talking about serial killers earlier, so I thought I would sort of bring this out. There's a lot of fetishes, guys, a lot of freaky things out there that people get sexually aroused about. And that hence the meaning of fetish. It's something that gets you excited sexually, and you just, it's a fetish. It's something that, something odd, something that doesn't usually, you know, isn't usually like felt that way by everybody. So I, you know, we all heard of the normal ones, necrophilism, there's foot fetishes, you know, there's S&M. I swear to God, I didn't know how many fetishes there were. There are a crap load of fetishes. I was amazed. I was like, oh my God, I didn't know that was a fetish. Acousophilia, it's the fetish of sound, of poetry, of hearing people talk, of accents. Oh, okay, that's cool. You know, I mean, there's a lot of really weird ones too. So in honor of this, and thanks to our friends at serialkillercalendars.com, I love those guys because they give me so many morbid facts about the serial killers I love. And they have merchandise and things. You can go on and play and pretend you're Daisy, whatever you want to do. But whatever floats your boat, whatever fetish you have. But I had to do this for Techie Yed, okay? He is missing. He is AWOL. He is on the run from the cops because of his necrophiliaism. Apparently, it's illegal. So I had to do this for Techie Yed, and we're going to instate this in the next, like, I don't know, however many shows it takes to get through all the fetishes, but I'd like to highlight a fetish, like either every show or every other show or something, because I think there's a lot of cool ones out there you guys don't know about. I guarantee there's like four or five that I went, what? That's a fetish? Who the hell is that? It's crazy. It's crazy, guys. So in honor of Techie Yed, the first fetish we're going to do, our fetish of the day, a definition and observation, things that fascinate me because there's so many fetishes I've never heard of, and unnatural love and its connections to serial killing, guys. We're going to celebrate necrophilia. Kind of odd. I only got 5 minutes. Work with me, all right? So necrophilia, which is also called necrolandia, is basically a fetish characterized by sexual attraction to corpses. It's actually derived from ancient Greek, and it figuratively means an inordinate desire to control another person, usually in the interpersonally controlling, better suited to relationships with non-responsive people. What better a non-responsive person than a stiff? I don't know, guys. Anyway, there's virtually no research conducted on this, its attraction among humans. There's been so many famous, Sigmund, Freud. No, I'm kidding, guys. I'm kidding. I like him. Anyway, there's so many different, philosophies about necrophilia. But, they said that basically what they can come up with is that the necrophile develops poor self-esteem, perhaps due in part to a significant loss. Which it's usually male, is very fearful of rejection by women, and he desires a sexual object who's incapable of rejecting him and or is fearful of the dead, and transform his fear of the dead by means of reaction formation into a desire for the dead. He develops an exciting fantasy of sex with a corpse, sometimes after exposure to a corpse. Basically, a sample of necrophiliacs, I don't know who submitted for this survey, 68% were motivated by a desire for an unresisting and unrejecting partner, 21% by a want for reunion with a lost partner, 15% by sexual attraction to dead people, 15% by a desire for comfort or to overcome feelings of isolation, and 12% by a desire to remedy low self-esteem by expressing power over a corpse. This study obviously has many flaws and cannot be taken as fact, but there's websites and there's groups and there's all sorts of things going on nowadays, guys, to support necrophiliaism. Modern research in England showed that a lot of necrophiles chose a dead mate after failing to create romantic attachments with the living. Sure. I don't know. Techie yet. My producers are cringing. I must be hitting on a high note. Basically, consent, there's an issue with necrophiliaism, consensuality. Although obtaining consent is not usually considered a prerequisite for activity with non-living material, sexual activity with a human corpse is taboo and frequently labeled abuse, based on the presumption that the person would not have consented to the act while alive and would thus constitute a profound, disturbing disrespect for their remains to be treated in a way other than their wishes. Virtually all human societies condemn sexual activity with the dead as a form of disrespect. Several groups, individuals, and publications have actually pushed for legalization of necrophiliac acts. The Necroerotic, for example, argues that necrophiliacs have as much right to engage in their orgasmic release of choice as do normal couples, and that all rights cease the moment a person draws their last breath. I don't know. What side of the fence are you on? I know what side Techie Yed's on, guys. And like I said, necrophilia has been so psychoanalyzed by people, by psychologists, philosophers. They say it's a character orientation, which is not necessarily sexual. It's expressed in an attraction to that which is dead or totally controlled. At the extreme, it results in hatred of life and destructiveness, hence serial killers. This is what they say. Necrophilia in history, it has a long, rich history. It was practiced in ancient cultures as a spiritual means of communicating with the dead. others employed as an attempt to revive the recently departed. Evidence of necrophilia can be found in artifacts of civilizations of South America. Pottery depicted skeletal figures engaged in coitus with living humans. Ancient Egypt, there's record of the treatment of bodies of young women were set out days before being delivered to the embalmers. They wanted the young women to rot for a few days before given to the embalmers in case the embalmers took a sexual interest in them. I don't know. Necrophilia in literature. It's been all over literature, guys. I mean, there's Books of the Dead, Toni Morrison's novel, Song of Solomon. You know, he finds the wife sleeping with a corpse. There's notable necrophiliacs. Carl Panzer, the guy in Florida we were talking about, took the lady, stuck a cup in her area, and proceeded to have sex with the cup. Replaced her skin with wax. I have like 30 seconds. I don't know what to do. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to keep going because it'll show up in archives, guys. And I don't know. You can listen to the last minute or two in the archive. But, you know, there was Karen Grenley who drove off in the 80s with a hearse and wasn't heard from for 2 days. She wrote a book, you know, The Unrepentant Necrophile. You know, all sorts of crazy stuff. Serial killers, Richard Chase, Ed Gein, Dennis Nilsen, Jerry Brudos, Ted Bundy, Jeffrey Dahmer, who ate his victims after killing them. It's just insane. You know, you had murderers that got sexual excitement from killing. You know, this one lady named Carla Faye Tucker claimed to have an orgasm every time she swung her axe to kill Jerry Lynn Dean. It's just insane. Attempted necrophilia. Charges were dropped when three men and this happened in 2006. Three men in Wisconsin stopped at a drugstore, picked up condoms, and went to the local cemetery because they saw a chick's photo in the obituary and thought she was hot and tried to dig up the corpse and have sex with it. Oh, my God. What? This skill goes on today. There's necrophilia among animals. Guys, there's actually an observation made in a very prominent psychology called the rape flight, where there was a bird that flew into a window and died, and a nearby bird went up and started mating with it for 75 minutes, taking breaks in between. I don't know what to say. Birds are doing it, guys. I don't know. It's insane. So, I mean, and these are actual psychological studies people have done. Necrophilia has run rampant through our history. Is it wrong? Is it right? I don't know. I'm not saying nothing. Hey, if you like it, whatever. I'm on the fence. But I don't know. I just find it fascinating that this goes on. It still happens today. What possesses you? I don't know. Whatever. Hey, if it floats your boat. But, I mean, and I'd like to say that there's actually – that was the whole rape flight thing that an actual psychologist witnessed happening outside of his window was the first recorded case of necrophilia in ducks, and though it's not the only case of homosexuality within the bird family. Who knew? Birds are – I don't know. I didn't know birds were queer. They are now. So heaven help us. I think they should have gay pride parades. I don't know. I'm fully willing to support equal rights for ducks as well. Why not? I didn't know this. No, I'm seriously not poking fun at anybody. I didn't know this. This is crazy. In the case of a praying mantis, they said that, you know, that's necrophilia. Some people say it's not because technically the mate has two hearts, so he's kind of still alive. Now get this. This is what cracks me up. Legality of it, guys. Techie Yed, you don't have anything to run from because the only states that have laws against specifically having sex with a corpse are Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Delaware, Florida, Georgia, Hawaii, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Washington, Minnesota, and Nevada. Those are the only states in the United States that actually have laws specifically barring sex with a corpse, guys. I don't know. I don't know. Whatever, whatever's happening, whatever floats your boat. That's just, it's funny. I don't know. I love it. Legality, United Kingdom. Sexual penetration with a corpse was made illegal under Sexual Offenses Act in 2003. They waited until 2003. Apparently there was a rash of sexual penetration amongst corpses. I don't know. Whatever. There's legality in India now. Apparently there's in the Indian Penal Code, Section 297 is entitled Trespassing and Burial Places. It does not specifically say not to have sex with a corpse, but it specifically says you are not to trespass on burial grounds and desecrate burial tombs, graves, anything in any way. So technically you dig up or you open a vault, you're trespassing. So you can get jail time under this law, but it doesn't specifically say you can't have sex with the corpse. I don't know. Whatever. So all I have to say is, apparently Illinois says it's okay. Don't run, my friend. Come back to us. It's all right. Indiana. I always knew that they liked necrophilia. Why not? They sleep with each other and they're half dead as it is. Keep it going, guys. So I don't know. I thought that was interesting. That's insane. That is technically the fetish of the day, guys. And that goes out to Techie Yed, who's on the run from the cops right now. And don't run, Techie Yed. Illinois says it's okay. So come on over. Come back home. Come back to the Genius Studios. But anyway, I just thought I'd give that. We ran over our time. It's been an action-packed night. I don't care that we ran over our time because I'm too excited. I'm too freaking excited. This was a great show. So I don't know. What did we have? We had the Go See Changeling. Incredible movie. Rob Dunbar. What a great guy. What a crazy, sadistic mind to tap into. I love it. I love sadistic writers. That's passion when you tap into carnal instinct. Love it. So good stuff. We talked about the Jersey Devil. We talked about necrophiliaism. Did you know as much about necrophiliaism as I just told you? Hell no. I didn't know. I'm fascinated by that. I think it's the oddest thing, but it's funny. I don't know. We laugh at it. It's sad. It's a little bit of both. I don't know. It's been in history. Is it right? Is it wrong? I don't know, guys. I'm not here to make judgment calls. I'm just here to entertain you and to report odd facts that you may or may not know. Anyway, I got to go. I'm blown over my time. The world's on fire. I got things to go do. I've got apparently corpses to go dig up. I don't know what's happening. I got to go watch Ducks and plan the next Pride Parade. So you know what, guys? From the GG Studios family to your home, I wish you a farewell, yes, with my bloody black heart, but I wish you a good night, and until next time, next week we got Black Wednesday, Lloyd Kaufman's on, Insanity, the King of Camp, the Head of Trauma. Stay tuned, 7 p.m. Wednesdays. A Working Podcast is next. We're part of the Horror Movie Radio Network now, guys, so stay tuned after us for A Working Podcast. Or if you're catching this on the archive, which you probably are right now, check them out as well, guys. Love you. Love all you little gorlings out there. Have a, I don't know, necrophiliac dream. I don't know. Have a good one, guys. Love ya.
Chicago.